Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thanks, Marshall, and welcome to Off Script, and welcome back to Jonathan Tunick. We were in the studio when we had an interview that you've already heard on Robin Hood Radio, and it went so swimmingly that it was suggested that we just sit here and continue the discussion. So I'm delighted to welcome back to Off Script Jonathan Tunick. In case you missed it the first time around, Jonathan really needs no introduction. Name a musical from Broadway. You've got a pretty good chance that he orchestrated it. Company, Follies, The Little Night Music, A Chorus Line, Titanic, Promises, Promises. Plus, I want to mention again that Jonathan Tunick is one of only 15 people with EGOT status. That's an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. Welcome back, and thanks for continuing the discussion.
It's good to be here, Dan.
So let's get back. We were talking about your early days when you were a kid, and you went to the Poconos and were working at a summer resort called Tantamount.
That's tantamount. No, it's tamament.
Tamament. Okay, I'm sorry.
Tamament. I don't know what it means either.
And just by way, for people that didn't listen to part one, briefly describe what it is, and then I want to talk a little bit more about the kind of people that you were working with while you were there.
Tamament was, and may still be for all I know, a summer resort in the Poconos, which was notable for the fact that it's weekly entertainment took the form of an original musical. There was a whole staff of actors, writers, director, choreographer, and a music staff, of which I, at age 21, became the arranger because they couldn't find anybody. I had applied for a job playing in the orchestra. They were over a barrel for an arranger, and they couldn't find anybody else, so they gave me the job.
So what other kind of people that we might have heard of later years were there at the same time you were?
Well, Tamament, over the years, and it started in the 1920s, through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, it became known as a breeding ground for television and Broadway. Some of the stars that came from Tamament were Barbara Cook, Jack Cassidy, Dorothy Loudon was there together
and
with me.
And you worked with her later.
Yeah.
And
Carol Burnett, Imogene Coca, Jerome Robbins.
We've heard of him, yes, indeed.
You know, that's just a short list.
Yeah, and Jonathan Tunick. Pretty heady stuff.
Yeah, what am I doing there?
I know, pretty heady stuff looking back at it.
The producer for many years was Max Liebman, who was involved in early television and early musical reviews on television and early what's the word for it? Variety shows
television. Remember them? Yeah.
Which became, because of him, very Tamament influenced, and a lot of the Tamament writers, such as the Simon brothers, Neil and Danny Simon, became the first television comedy writers.
Fascinating. You have gone on in later years, besides all the great Broadway stuff you've done, to also orchestrate a lot of television stuff. Did you do any television in the early days with any of those people? Did that come later after
that
you?
That came later. Yeah. And actually, I never orchestrated for television.
You composed, right?
I was interested in being a film composer.
Okay.
And the first step to that was series television.
Right.
Quite a few of my composer friends, David Shire, who I mentioned last time being one of them, had gone to California and had great success first in television and then movies. And they were very nice about introducing me around and helping me get started. So one of the first things I did was a trip to Universal where they would hire new people. My first assignment was a Columbo.
Ah, this is after you've done Broadway stuff.
Yeah.
Hmm? 60s, 70s stuff, yeah.
And I did quite a bit of that. Then Angela Lansbury, when she had her series, Murder, She Wrote, was terrific about using New York people. Anybody that came out to California could get onto that show.
She remembered her buddies.
Yeah. George Hearn, Len Carey, mm-hmm. both got recurring parts right. on the show. And anybody, John Rubenstein did one. Harvey Fierstein did one. I'm just talking about the episodes that I scored.
Did you score the titles, the title music?
No, that was global. That okay. came with the show.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a very good theme, by the way.
Very
open to variation.
Well, we remember it, and I don't think it's because they have like 500.
But it has all little nooks and crannies that you can exploit with variations.
What's the difference? You've done your own compositions for the stage too, I guess. But what's the difference? And maybe this question also applies to arrangement. What's the difference between working when you're composing or orchestrating something for the stage as opposed to composing or arranging something for film or television?
Well, first of all, in strictly practical terms, the stage is immediate. It's performed live. And it has to be fairly danger-free. You can do much more complex things on film because it's recorded. It can be carefully rehearsed. And once you have it down, the problem is solved.
Right.
Not so in the theater. It has to be performed over and over. And you could go on and on about details of how that fact manifests itself. But there's an even bigger difference, a more profound difference. Film, and I put television in that category too, is an illusion. You go see a film and you're drawn into it as though it's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
Where theater is a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And you participate in it in a different way. You're aware always that these are living, the performers are living things. And it's very interesting. I find that the rituals of the theater are important.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the intermission. There's something about the theater that demands an intermission. There have been directors who try to do without it. They're afraid of it. They're afraid they'll lose the concentration of their audience. And I think it works the other way around. You lose your audience, you're more likely to lose your audience by not having an intermission.
Unless you've got a really remarkable property, right?
What I'm
thinking about now is Follies, and there's always a debate whether that should get an intermission mm-hmm. or not, and some very successful revivals, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole.
My opinion is...
Yeah, sure.
My opinion is it comes in two parts.
Yeah.
It needs an intermission because every show needs an intermission.
Okay.
B, they never found, it was not written with a place for an intermission.
Follies was never written for an intermission.
Yeah.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
So you run into a little problem there.
Right.
If you do it with an intermission, you gain something, but you lose something because it's a little awkward getting back into the show. On the other hand, if you do it straight through, you get a little fidgety.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's get back now. You talked about composing or orchestrating for the immediacy and the ritual observance that occurs in the theater. So what's it like to compose or orchestrate or arrange for film or TV? Is that something that's more removed?
It is.
Yeah.
the composer isn't even hired till the movie is shot and edited. And you can then look at a finished film. At least you hope it's finished, because there are lots of directors that'll keep cutting even after the fact. Mm-hmm. And you're approaching a fixed thing.
Mm-hmm. What about the phenomenon? And we see more of this, I think, in the theater these days. I'm thinking of productions like Choir Boy, where you have not musicals but plays with music. You know.
Well, there were always those.
Yeah.
There were always plays with music. In fact, if you read back, I'm thinking of Russell Bennett's memoirs. Mm-hmm. He talks about writing and performing music for Lionel Barrymore in Peter Ibbotson, mm-hmm. as a play, mm-hmm. with considerable amount, yeah. of music in it. Probably more back then than there is now.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah. And you've orchestrated for those as well, yeah?
Plays? No. Not much.
Not so much?
I've written incidental music for plays, but mostly back in college.
Okay. Let's talk about your own composition. And the reason why I bring this up is that I was talking to some friends who are professionally committed to the theater, and they remember very fondly something at Playwrights Horizon in April 1979 called The Songs of Jonathan Tunick.
Isn't that interesting? I'd forgotten about that. Yeah,
and they loved it, and they said, if you're interviewing him, ask him about that. So I'm asking you about
funny?
That.
Yeah. How nice of them, whoever they are. Ira Weitzman, who has been at Lincoln Center forever, was then at Playwrights Horizons, and so was Andre Bishop. Mm-hmm. And they came to me and said, do you have a musical? And I didn't, mm-hmm. and I wasn't in the mood to write one. You can more about that later if you want.
I do.
And I said, but I have a whole backlog of songs that I've written for musicals that never got on or that weren't written for musicals at all, and what they call art songs, which means poems set to music. And they thought that was kind of a nice idea, so I put together a program with three singers, and my old colleague Danny Troub volunteered to play the piano, which he does very well, unlike myself. And there was this program at Playwrights Horizons. That's right, it was 1979.
Well, they loved it. And I guess the question, if I could ask so boldly, is you started out the first interview that we did before talking about your attraction to orchestration was finding the characters in the music.
Well, the fact that the orchestra, that the musical instruments could participate,
right.
in the theater by not only telling the stories but actually playing characters.
Right. I guess the question is that is it that you're so good at orchestration that that's what you do, or and that's why you didn't compose a musical on your own, or have you never had any interest in composing musicals yourself, or perhaps you are?
How intriguing! No, I always composed.
Mm-hmm.
As we discussed last time, I had a go at writing musicals at college. Mm-hmm. Very interesting thing happened in my development. My musical development. First of all, I never found an ideal collaborator.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to several of my friends is that they became their own lyricists, mm-hmm. from lack of finding a decent lyricist, like Ed Kleban, for example.
Chorus Line.
Yeah. He and I were old friends. We went to high school together. One of my several early music buddies. I never found a lyricist that had ever became anything. And the little experience I did have writing musicals, I got a show on, worked on it for 2 years, got a production at the Playhouse in the Park in Cincinnati. and that combined with the fact that I was now doing orchestration for Broadway shows and working with composers and seeing what they went through led me to conclude that I am by nature not meant for being a theater composer. I don't like having to constantly rewrite. I'm by nature much more inclined to be an orchestrator where I can finish the show and be done with it and move on to something else.
What about your own music now? I mean,
I've gone back to writing original music, which I have done from time to time all along, but not shows. I write songs for, I don't like the term art songs. It sounds pretentious. What the Germans call Lieder, and what the French, even better, they just call them chansons.
Yeah.
And they are poems set to music, usually by great poets of the past, mm-hmm. but sometimes by people I actually know, mm-hmm. Lyricists. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing quite a good amount of choral music. There's a very fine choral conductor named Judith Clerman, who's taken a liking to my music mm-hmm. and had been encouraging me to write choral music, and she's had several of my pieces published and recorded. Also instrumental music.
What are you finding in the poetry and the choral music what you didn't see before?
You mean what in the poetry?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've done big Broadway shows. Everybody knows the music that you've orchestrated. They're part of our culture. And so this sounds like a very, very intimate and very private kind of exercise.
It is, and that's exactly it. There are no other people making demands on me. I can go where it takes me. The text itself will or won't take me to music. I even think that the poem asks to be set to music. Mm-hmm. The poem asks for music. If it doesn't, I don't have to set it.
Is it the rhythm in the poetry? Because most poetry does have some rhythm.
It may be.
Yeah.
That's one possibility. It may just be
the idea,
the context of the idea of the poem itself awakes something in me that makes me want to contribute something to it. But the concept that I always use, and I teach a little. I have a few mm-hmm. students, and what I always say to my students when they come to me, say, with an orchestration project or a composition project for their own orchestration, I'll say, what does the music want? Mm-hmm. Do what the music wants. First you have to find out what it wants. Then do what the music wants. And so it is with setting a text. My teacher, Paul Nordorf, used to talk about this.
Can you share with us some of the poems that you've worked on?
I've set quite a bit of Yeats mm-hmm. and Cummings. Mm-hmm. Right now I have on my list, and I've been working on Rupert Brooke. Mm-hmm. I've been working on...
It's There's a lot of pain in Rupert Brooke too.
Yeah,
it's World War One.
Judy Clearman sent me a poem. This is very interesting, by a Hungarian poet named Hannes Senes, who wrote in Hebrew. She was a she emigrated to Israel, and she had a very interesting career. During World War II, she was safely in British Palestine and volunteered to be parachuted into Europe to help Jews escape, and she was caught and killed by the Nazis. She wrote a lot of poetry in Hebrew because it was a matter of pride for these people that they learn and speak Hebrew.
Right.
Now, my knowledge of Hebrew... Well, you're an Irish Catholic.
What do I know?
I'm a West Side Jewish kid. My joke is my knowledge of Hebrew.
So what do you know Hebrew?
I got about to Gimel, which I think is the fourth or fifth letter in the alphabet. And it's very interesting because Judy gave me what's it called when it's in English letters?
A bilingual translation.
Yeah. Yes, but also syllable by syllable.
Phonetic.
Yeah. Thank you. And I was able actually to set this to music, even though I don't speak the language. I had a good translation, which of course didn't fit the rhythm at all, but Judy helped me with all that because she knows Hebrew. It came out pretty
nice,
pretty successfully.
Nice.
Anyway, you asked about poets. I've been interested recently in Sarah Teasdale?
Yes.
Rachel Lindsay?
Yes. Oh, yes. Mm. That's sort of out of the Harlem Renaissance.
They had an affair, you know.
I didn't know that.
Which I didn't know till later. Yeah. I had said a poem of Rachel Lindsay's called The Mysterious Cat for chorus. Mm-hmm. And then later on, looking through Sarah Teasdale, I learned that they'd been an item.
Fascinating.
She was a very popular poet in her time.
In her time.
She was pretty much forgotten.
She is now, except in rare books, rare bookshops.
Rachel Lindsay, too?
Yeah.
They have an enormous book of his collected poems.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows him anymore. There are composers like that, too.
What were some of your favorite composers when you were a kid?
Oh, I'm not going to amaze you with any of my answers, but naturally the great classics, the three B's.
Yep.
I liked French music. I liked Debussy. I liked because of the beautiful textures of his music, Delius, and. And some of the tougher modern music,
right.
Bartok and Stravinsky. There's nothing amazing about these answers. Mahler.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing about those answers is going to give you any great insight.
No, but given your appreciation, how you were born to do what you do, okay, when you're presented with a score that's going to be staged, and you've got such a vocabulary and such an encyclopedia of music to rely on in your own head, I guess the question that I want to conclude on, of all the stuff you've done, what was the real stumper? What was the score you were presented with it? And you said, how the hell am I going to make...
That's a good one, yeah.
How the hell am I going to make this really, really work?
What a terrific question.
I have two answers.
One was company.
Yeah, and we've mentioned that before.
We've touched on that before. Well, first of all, it was my first show with Sondheim.
Right.
as well as my first show with Halprin's.
Right.
I had one major credit, which Promises, which was pretty demanding on its own. But at least I knew what the music was supposed to sound like. Burt Bacharach has his sound, and he was very helpful to me in in recreating that sound.
And what was
He's
the other
a great
one?
Composer, by the way.
Right.
And also, the music itself of Company was so groundbreaking and so unlike anything else that in so many cases, you couldn't fall back on the tried and true formulas.
And what was the other one?
Of Broadway orchestration. A Little Night Music.
Ah, my other favorite.
I sat there with You Must Meet My Wife, banging my head against the table. What am I going to do with this music? It sounds beautiful on the piano. How do I translate it into the orchestra? Because Steve's piano accompaniment consists of these flowing arpeggios where one chord just bleeds into the other. And in any given case, is it a G minor or is it an A minor? I mean, because one note from the last chord is bleeding over into the next. It was mind-boggling trying to solve that. I think I solved it, but it didn't come easy.
You know, we could go on again and again. We've got to conclude the program. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you again for coming on. It's been a thrill talking with you. And I want to just say thank you for all those people who've spent many evenings in Broadway theater for making us a little bit better.
Well, thank you. It was great to be here.
Thanks for listening to Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer, the program underwritten by Johnny Cake Books. Until the next time, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.